nosotras, nuestros cuerpos, nuestras vidas.
Ni una menos, ni una menos, ni una menos,
ni una menos.
Que lo de uno se apodere de ti, todo con amor, siempre desde la comprensión. Sé que la solución.
recent example being Afghanistan, where after 20 years, US and NATO were defeated, suffered a crushing defeat when they had to withdraw and Taliban retook Afghanistan, took over Afghanistan again. So that was a crushing defeat for US and NATO in Afghanistan. And before that, Iraq, which the US invaded twice during the Gulf War I and Gulf War II, and where the US wanted to extend its hegemony there by force, has now become free from US foreign policy. It is pursuing an independent foreign policy and actually aligning itself to of United States arc force. Like the current Iraq regime is very close to Iran. They have close ties and they are working together against US interests in the region. Not only that, Iraq also has aligned itself very closely with Russia. So the US has lost influence in Iraq as well. In Syria, starting in 2011, the US, when there was the Arab Spring, the US saw an opportunity to take advantage of the unfolding situation on the ground by trying to intervene on behalf of some of opposition forces to bring down Assad and then enter Russia on behalf of Assad and then pro-US proxy forces on the ground were blown away. And again, so the US lost in Syria as well to Assad and Russia. And beyond that, we saw the attack on Libya, NATO attack on Libya in 2011. Even though they succeeded to bring down Gaddafi, the US still could not exert control over Libya. So that was another strategic loss. So many strategic losses for the US in the Middle East and in Central Asia and in North Africa. So after Afghanistan, the US decided that Africa should be its fallback to go back to Africa, entrench itself in Africa, and rebuild its global hegemony from Africa, Somalia being one of the most strategic places in the continent, lying on the confluence where the Indian Ocean, the Gulf of Aden, and the Red Sea converge, and where the oil tankers almost one third or some maybe yeah one third of oil tankers go through the Suez Canal through Somalia. So it saw the opportunity to go and reassert itself in Africa, which also has a lot of oil, not only in Somalia, but the entire continent. In the last 10 years, we have seen spectacular discoveries of oil across Africa in places like Mali, Ghana, Cameroon, but also in East Africa, Tanzania and Mozambique, where they discovered huge oil reserves offshore on the Indian Ocean, and then onshore oil resources in places like Uganda, in the Lake Albert region, and in northern Kenya as well. So there's been spectacular discoveries of oil across Africa. And this is in addition to the six traditional African countries that are among the main oil producers in the continent. That includes Nigeria, Angola, Libya, Equatorial Guinea, Congo, Brazzaville, and Gabon. So Africa sits on huge untapped oil resources, and the US would like to take control of these oil resources, especially that it has been trying to force Europe, Western Europe, and the EU to end their dependence on Russian oil. And so the US...
Can I just get in here for brief, because you said they're trying to establish their hegemony here.
Yes.
What are the, just remind the listeners about AFRICOM, what it how it works and how it operates and how it relates to African countries.
Yeah, AFRICOM became operational in 2007 during the reign of George W. Bush. It is headquartered in Stuttgart, but it has a de facto headquarters in Africa, in Djibouti. A lot of people don't know that, because the US and France, they have a huge presence on Djibouti. And actually, most of they always say, you know, Africa is headquartered in Stuttgart, but I think the de facto headquarters now is in Djibouti, because the US tried to establish an open base in Africa, an official African base recognizable in Africa. But because there was a lot of public outcry, and then they decided the headquarters would remain in Stuttgart. But technically, Djibouti serves as an headquarters, because a lot of operations, African operations in Eastern Africa and the Horn of Africa take place from Djibouti. So the purpose of AFRICOM was to help the US secure vital resources in Africa, especially oil and minerals. While the US has been imposing a neoliberalism as an economic system for Africa, they realized that will not be enough. They needed to secure these resources through military operations, and that's why AFRICOM was set up, primarily to secure those vital resources in Africa. And they have boots on the ground in different countries in Africa. So they use US troops stations in Djibouti, across the Sahel as well. They have troops over there. And they claim that they are there to train African forces. But the main point, idea, is to secure those vital resources militarily in case they face opposition in the African continent. So we see African operations being expanded. And just recently, between May 10th and May 21st, the AFRICOM commander, Stephen Townsend, was on a tour across East Africa. And also Angola. He was in Djibouti, Somalia, Kenya, Rwanda, and Angola. So they are looking to expand AFRICOM's operation now in Africa. So and because also the US has been facing another challenge from China in terms of the rise of China in the African continent. Now their fallback is AFRICOM, so they want to expand AFRICOM operations to challenge China and Russia as well.
Wow, and it's boots on the ground. It's military agreements with almost every African country
Exactly. Almost, I think 34, 35 African countries. That's official, but unofficially, it can be more than that. Yeah, it can be close to 40 African countries. And the second reason I said is why they are coming to Somalia, and practically it will extend across the continent, is the situation in Ukraine. So the US has been trying to force the EU to end their dependence on Russian oil and gas. And the EU are saying it's not easy to find alternatives. So the US is trying to look for that alternative for Europe. And then what will happen is that the plan is for US oil companies to take over African oil and gas fields and then sell the oil to Europe. So that's another plan, a geopolitical reason why we see US troops returning to Somalia. So it's not just about Somalia, but this is part of our wider scheme, given the recent tour of the African commander across several African countries.
Well, given that the countries of Africa in large numbers have signed agreements with the US and its military strategy, to follow its military strategy. And for that matter, a large number of African leadership are trained in World Bank and IMF. They came out of those bodies as trainees and so on. So they're very much committed to the American neocolonial or neoliberal, sorry. Actually, it's not all that different, is it? Why do you think then that the Americans and for that matter the Ukrainians have been getting such a lukewarm reception from African leaders with respect to the current crisis that's going on with Russia and the Ukraine and NATO?
The reason is that first of all, Africa, the African Union and African people, they see this conflict as geopolitical. They look at it as in geopolitical terms. And Africa understands geopolitics more than anyone else because it has been at the receiving end of geopolitical expansion of the West for so long since the Cold War. So the African Union sees the conflict as one pitting NATO against Russia with Ukraine caught in between. So given that the African Union sees this conflict as geopolitical, then it thinks that it should take a non-aligned stance on this conflict. And actually, people forget that 25 African countries actually condemned the invasion in Russia. That's a little more than half of African countries. 24 abstained, and only one, Eritrea, openly backed Russia in its ongoing war in Ukraine. So the 24 abstentions doesn't mean that Africa is snubbing Ukraine. It's more of a reflection of a continent taking a non-aligned stance on this issue. So Africa Union believes that this is a geopolitical conflict and it should take a non-aligned stance. And also during the Cold War, that pitted the East and West, it should remember that many African countries were part of the non-aligned movements. So non-alignment is not new to Africa. And in cases where there are crises or conflicts that are geopolitical in nature, then Africa will always, most of the time, take a non-aligned stance on the conflict. So that's what's happening with Africa. The African Union said they want de-escalation because the African Union believes that sanctions that are being the sanctions that are being imposed on Russia are only escalating the conflict. So Africa is not going to join the EU and other countries that are imposing sanctions on Russia. They see sanctions as an escalation. And they also see the shipment of multi-billion dollar weapons. Like Biden announced at Iran around 40 billion of military and development aid to Ukraine last week. So the African Union also sees this as an escalation. So it favors peace, dialogue. First of all, de-escalation, and then dialogue and peaceful settlement to this conflict. That is the position of the African Union.
And is not, I'm sorry, the Senegalese president.
Oh, yes. Macky Sall, the Senegalese president, who is the chairman of the African Union, the current chairman of the African Union, just announced a few days ago that he will be heading to both Moscow and Kyiv, where he will meet President Putin and also later on President Zelensky. He's going there on behalf of the African Union. It is not a trip just by Macky Sall on his own, but he's going there under the auspices of the African Union. And what he said is that the African Union wants de-escalation and it wants a dialogue and a peaceful negotiations to end this conflict. It doesn't support sanctions and other measures that the African Union sees as an escalation of this conflict. So not only that, after Macky Sall's returns from the trip to Kyiv and Moscow, President Zelensky will have the opportunity to speak to the African Union. He has been asking for that opportunity to speak to the African Union. And so he will get his time to speak to the African Union. A lot of the Western media has been saying, "Oh, the African Union, they don't want to speak to Mr. Zelensky," but that will happen soon, and where Mr. Zelensky will be able to deliver a speech to the African Union. It will be virtually, but he will be able to speak to the majority of African leaders on the conflict. And he can ask what he wants from Africa. So that one is coming as well. So we cannot say entirely that Africa is not supporting Ukraine. It's only that Africa favors a non-aligned position because it sees this as a geopolitical context. And it doesn't support sanctions and other measures like armed shipments, because the African Union believes those only serve to escalate the conflicts further. Yeah.
Well, and just looking back historically, you took it back to the Cold War, the whole building of alignments. But in fact, I'd take it even back to the geopolitics of the scramble for Africa in 1871 or 5, when Africa was just a continent set for carving up spheres of influence between the European powers. And I've heard people say that, in fact, NATO today is just the military arm of the World Bank and the IMF to maintain neoliberal, neocolonial control over resources in not just Africa, but they're extending themselves as far as Eastern Europe and South Pacific, for crying in the soup. Afghanistan, what did that have to do with NATO? North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Anyway, I don't know how you feel about that, but... that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, it's true, because if you look at, there was a recent wave of coups in West Africa, almost in 5 countries, in Mali, Niger, Guinea. And what everybody knows is that most of these military officials behind these coups, they are Western trained. Most of them are trained in the US. And then when a regime tries to entangle itself, African government tries to entangle itself from the West and from US influence, and then we see recurrent coups. So NATO countries like US and France and Belgium have been behind many coups in Africa since independence in 1960. And so they use proxies in African militaries to bring down governments. We saw the brutal killing of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah. We saw the assassination of Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. So this has been going on for so long. And also, one thing I forgot about is when the Soviet Union was supporting African liberation movement, especially in Southern Africa, to fight against Western colonialism, the US was backing, and the US and other Western countries were backing reactionary forces. For example, they were supporting UNITA in Angola, arming and supporting UNITA in Angola, and also support the CIA and the South African Defense Forces were involved in the conflict in Angola for over 20 years at the behest of the US. And we saw how the US and other Western countries backed RENAMO in Mozambique. So wherever, throughout the struggle of decolonization in Africa, especially in Southern Africa, the US and West were involved in supporting and arming proxies on the ground to continue to entrench imperialism. So NATO countries had a hand in many coups in Africa, and also they have supported and backed and armed many proxy forces across the continent. So it's kind of an enforcer of what's happening on the African continent. And we saw NATO intervention in Libya in 2010.
My goodness, that was massive and
direct. Exactly. Yes, completely destroyed Libya, not only destroyed, but also destabilized the entire region. We saw how returning Tuareg rebels went into Mali, and then there was a insecurity across Mali and Niger. And then we saw how French intervened in Mali as well. So Africa itself has suffered NATO aggression. People just talk about Afghanistan, but we saw how an African country like Libya was laid to waste by NATO aggression. And that's another reason why Africa is opposed to the war in Ukraine, why it sees it as a geopolitical war, because Africa itself has suffered from NATO aggression in 2011. And we see also continued aggression by NATO countries in Africa, like the French occupation in Mali. So always NATO and AFRICOM that work in tandem have used military force across the African continent to impose and entrench Western imperialism.
And what's your
What's
your view then on the claim that Russia has extended its military influence in Africa and using contractors and mercenaries and other means of co-opting African leaders?
It's true. Russia is providing has a military partner with a number of African countries. It's mostly through arms sales. They are selling arms to a number of African countries. But African countries are saying this is not new. This military cooperation between Africa and Russia dates back to the days of Pan-African liberation, when African countries were fighting against colonialism and the Soviet Union, led by Russia, supported African countries politically, but also diplomatically and also militarily. So they say this is part of the longer history they had with Russia. Although Russia, I think, when there was after the Cold War, for about 20 years, it stepped back a little bit. But African countries are saying that they had this diplomatic, military, and relations with Russia for a long time, dating back to the era of decolonization. And it's true that Wagner Group, which is a private military contractor, has some footprint on Africa. But countries like Mali, they're claiming that Wagner is helping them secure, defeat forces, rebel forces that are fighting against the Malian government, that are trying to overthrow the Malian government, and that they have asked the French forces to leave. So it's another way of to force out Western forces from African occupation. And African countries are saying that the use of, if there is a, although they don't admit it openly, but they will argue that the use of these private contractors is just temporary to achieve some military objectives on the ground. So Russia's has influence over Africa, but this influence gets back to historical relations since during the struggle for decolonization in Africa.
Fine. I know we didn't plan this, but you know, can you give us a thumbnail update on what's happening in the Ethiopia Tigrayan situation? Because you haven't really mentioned it as part of all of this, but I'm sure the parties we're talking about in the geopolitical sense have had their finger in this pot.
Oh, yes. Ethiopia now has been moving towards de-escalation over the last 6 months. And so the conflict now is on its, gradually it's entering the de-escalation phase. but there still hasn't been a face-to-face meeting or negotiation between Abiy Ahmed and the rebels in the north. But we expect that to come soon through the African Union. So what happened was that in Ethiopia, which has very close ties with China and now with Russia, and also Turkey, which provided those decisive drones that prevented the TPLF takeover of Addis Ababa 6-7 months ago, has always been caught on these geopolitical matrix between East and West. During the Colonel Mengistu's reign in the 70s, Ethiopia was allied with the Soviet Union, but after Mengistu's fall, when the TPLF took power, the TPLF tried to play a double game. They aligned the same with the West in terms of economic aid, in terms of military aid, becoming so-called enforcer of U.S. war on terror in the Horn of Africa. But on the economic front, they were busy building the development state assisted by Chinese development aid that was largely in the areas of building modernist infrastructure for Ethiopia. So while Abiy Ahmed in the early days of his reign was trying to reach out to the West, he later on fell out of the West. And there are claims that also the US was backing the TPLF rebels to bring down the Abiy Ahmed government, because it had close ties with the TPLF in the past, which served its interest in terms of being the enforcer in the war on terror, so-called war on terror in the Horn of Africa, particularly the intervention in Somalia. So Ethiopia is caught up in that geopolitical contest between East and West. Not forgetting that Ethiopia recently discovered a lot of oil. There is huge oil deposits in the Ogaden Basin in eastern Ethiopia, both oil and natural gas. So this is something also the West is eyeing. And actually China has contracts to extract this oil, and the West also has their eye on this as well. So Ethiopian conflict, a lot of people, what the media, Western media was trying to say was it is just a conflict between the Tigray, TPLF and Abiy Ahmed government, but it has its like, geopolitical dimensions as well. Yeah.
Wow, what a massive overview, Fareed. I really appreciate this. I'm sure the listeners of Amandla will find it very interesting to have this alternative view to the dominant, it's not even a dialogue, the dominant narrative. No, it's a dominant monologue that we see in the media here of the terrible Russians and the wonderful Ukrainians. And of course, I won't even get into the injustice of how many African refugees are dying trying to cross the Mediterranean, and the Ukrainians are being flown here in massive numbers as refugees and accepted open arms. So Canada's hypocrisy on the immigration front is also a very tragic reflection of that kind of imperial, still live imperial policy. So I thank you so much, and I appreciate your support, and it's been wonderful talking to you today.
Thanks for having me, Doug, and talk to you next time. Thank you very much.
Thanks again. We'll be right back.
that they rack my brain, trying to understand politics again and again. Politicians use the same tactics.
Would be a serious error not to mention the work of GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa. For many years, they have spoken out against the militarization and presence of NATO and US forces on the continent. GRILA's Aziz Fall has produced a documentary entitled AFRICOM Go Home. I quote the following from the GRILA website at www.grila.org. Their declaration on the 50th anniversary of the African Liberation Day back in 2013. That declaration starts by recalling the statement of the founding of the Organization of African Unity in 1963, which reads, "We, the heads of African states and governments assembled in the city of Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, convinced that it is the inalienable right of all people to control their own destiny, conscious of the fact that freedom, equality, justice, and dignity are essential objectives for the achievement of the legitimate aspirations of the African people, conscious of our responsibility to harness the natural and human resources of our continent for the total advancement of our people in spheres of human endeavor." GRILA says, some 50 years later, although the African Union has replaced the Organization of African Unity, Africa is still struggling to realize her full potential and exercise her right to self-determination. The continent remains mired in disadvantage perpetuated by an international labor sector held captive within an imperialistic system resolutely opposed to Pan-Africanism. Indeed, for the West, Pan-Africanism is a threat to Western interests. From its base in Stuttgart, AFRICOM, the U.S. African Command, is designed to take advantage of an extraordinary conjuncture of political, geographical, economic and geostrategic disputes that are undermining the continent. AFRICOM continues to serve the exclusive interests of dominant countries and their local comprador elites. A base on the African continent is a guarantee of long-term access to Africa's raw materials and locations of strategic importance. No NATO country really needs to establish such huge military base anywhere in Africa. Intentionally or not, such factors generally fuel terrorism, which sprouts predictably wherever underdevelopment has created a climate where it can thrive. Besides, the imperialists have worked tirelessly to stifle democratic developments and movements in Africa. It has created a fictitious sense of democracy, which has depoliticized the African populations and left Africa's countries victims of a particularly vicious virus of dependency. There's also growing networks of terrorists and politicized outlaws who march to their own drum and threaten world order just as much as they do the African countries they attack. However, these are merely the tip of the iceberg. More often than not, the origins of such conflicts, which the powers that be make a show of stamping out, lie in poverty and underdevelopment. In continental terms, this equals a violation of Africa's right to self-determination. Pan-Africanists have a duty to build an internationalism that will wake up African elites as well as the masses of African people and make them aware that Africa's very, very sovereignty depends on dismantling all foreign bases. Pan-African presumes a self-reliant continental integration whose goal is social projects. In defending the interests of African people, we must depend on our own sense of unity and stop waiting for NATO or AFRICOM to do the job for us. That is the only way we can be assured of charting our own path and bringing about the integrated development of the African continent. We thank you, GRILA, for keeping this issue alive.
Alors, le film est un film de contre-propagande pour montrer l'ampleur de la recolonisation en cours au niveau géopolitique du continent africain. Il s'agit d'un film qui suit les traces du président Obama, mais aussi de notre travail de plaidoyer contre la présence de la base de l'AFRICOM à Stuttgart, une base qui assure tout un réseau de satellites africains. Et l'histoire explique en fait comment la géopolitique du chaos s'instaure sur le continent africain. En somme, les pays de l'OCDE, de l'OTAN, ayant perdu au niveau économique dans la coopération internationale, sont obligés de recourir aux leviers géopolitiques pour rendre indispensable leur parrainage des pays africains, eux-mêmes exposés à une nébuleuse terroriste qui n'est plus contrôlable, mais qui a été semée par ces mêmes pays qui prétendent les soutenir aujourd'hui. Et donc le film, qui est extrêmement long, explique en fait la vision qu'avaient les pères fondateurs et revient sur les 50 ans des indépendances africaines et explique en fait la généalogie des conflits en montrant que produisent ces bases et surtout pourquoi cette base a été implantée en Allemagne, dans un chantage sur l'or de l'Allemagne, dans un chantage qui ne tient pas compte du fait que cette base viole l'article 25 et 26 de l'Allemagne, la propre constitution. Et le film montre en fait que les Allemands, comme les Africains, ignorent l'ampleur de ce qui se passe. Donc le film est un film de contre-propagande, disponible sur l'internet, AFRICOM Go Home, et issu donc de cette déclaration, traduit en 9 langues, et il est en version anglaise, française et allemande sur YouTube.
I have news from this week from Khartoum. Sudan's president of the Sovereignty Council, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, declared that he will lift the nationwide state of emergency, which came into effect following the military October 25th coup and was underpinned by the dissolution of the transitional cabinet, and also it initiated nationwide anti-coup protests that have rocked Sudan ever since. I have two reports, the first from Africa News and the other from India's WION network.
The Sudanese military ruler lifted Sunday the state of emergency imposed since the October coup. The decree also provides that people detained under an emergency law are to be freed. The news came the same day as the UN envoy for Sudan regretted the killing of two anti-coup protesters in Khartoum Saturday. Calling for the violence to stop, local protests urged the authorities to engage in a peaceful way out of the crisis. Saturday's protests were part of relentless demonstrations across the country. Hundreds of people marched in the capital, demanding the return of constitutional order. Medical groups say nearly 100 demonstrators were killed since the protests began 7 months ago. Following the October 2021 coup, the ruling generals have rejected calls to hand over power before the July 2023 elections. The African Union, an East African regional group, and the UN have been leading efforts to bridge the gap between the people and the military authorities and find a way out of the impasse.
Meanwhile, Sudan's military chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has lifted a state of emergency that was imposed following a military coup last year. The ruling Sovereign Council has said that the decision was taken to prepare an atmosphere for fruitful dialogue in order to achieve stability for the transitional period. The Sudan has been suffering a deep political crisis after al-Burhan, who is also the general commander of the Sudanese armed forces, declared a state of emergency in October last year and also dissolved the Sovereign Council and the government. This decision has come after the latest calls by the United Nations Special Representative Volker Perthes for lifting the state of emergency following the killing of two protesters during the anti-coup protests last Saturday. The Sudan has been witnessing mass protests since the 25th of October last year, which has met a violent crackdown. According to reports, the crackdown has left nearly about 100 people dead and hundreds of others are wounded. The decision also comes after a meeting with senior military officials. They recommended that the state of emergency should be lifted and people detained under an emergency law should be freed. In another development on Sunday, the trial of four people accused of fatally stabbing a senior police officer, General Ali Barima, has opened in Khartoum. Barima was killed in January during the anti-coup protests. The accused were arrested in the same month, held a week-long hunger strike, alleging inhuman treatment in prison. This also triggered some massive protests outside of the courthouse with the demand to release the defendants. The Sudan has been reeling from the deepening unrest since Burhan-led coup. This upended a fragile transition following the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir, and there was widespread international condemnation of the military's takeover. The Western governments have also announced some punitive measures, which included the cutting of crucial aid in order to force the military leader to transition to civilian rule. The Sudan remains one of the world's poorest countries. It is struggling from a plunging economy due to the decades of international isolation and mismanagement under Bashir. To facilitate the Sudanese-led talks to resolve the crisis, the United Nations has been working along with the African Union and the regional bloc IGAD. The Burhan has pledged to free political detainees to set the stage for the talks. Vyond is now available in your country. Download the app now and get all the news on the move.
Music and anti-fascism. Reflections on the past and possibilities in the present. Join us for a concert July 7th featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, free improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022 at 9 p.m. La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni Peri Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Report in January from Oxfam South Africa indicated that economic inequality had been widening since the COVID-19 pandemic began. The widening economic, gender, and racial inequalities, as well as the inequality that exists between countries, are tearing our world apart. This is according to Oxfam International's Inequality Kills report. South African Broadcasting Corporation News interviews Tembinkosi Dlamini, who is senior extractives lead at Oxfam South Africa.
The wealth of the world's 10 richest men has doubled since the pandemic began. So the incomes of 99% of humanity are worse off because of COVID-19. Widening economic, gender, and racial inequalities, as well as the inequality that exists between countries, are tearing the world apart. This is according to an Oxfam International's Inequality Kills report. Let's explore this now in the South African context with Tembinkosi Dlamini, who is a senior executive leading there at Oxfam South Africa. A very good afternoon to you, sir. Thanks indeed for your time. So how much more worse off are we? Because according to that report, from what I saw, women, ethnic minorities in developing countries have been hardest hit by growing inequality since the start of this pandemic.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for having us. Indeed, the developing world, especially low-income countries, ethnic minorities in them, women in particular, have been made far worse off since the beginning of the pandemic. This is not surprising because even before the pandemic, women in particular were at the periphery of the economy. They were involved in mostly precarious jobs, jobs without security, jobs where you have to work long hours, unsafe working conditions, and they were not allowed to unionize and therefore bargain for their rights. So with the coming in of the pandemic, women in particular lost jobs in higher numbers because most of the jobs that were occupied by women in bulk, they were jobs that did not require that much in terms of skills or qualifications. So they are unlikely going to rejoin the job market as well, even after the pandemic.
And this is quite dangerous, is it? Because according to your report as well, black women are already the least likely to be employed in South Africa.
Yes, that is correct. They are unlikely going to be re-employed, especially in South Africa, because the economy is not creating new jobs. It is rather shedding jobs. Now, with the lockdown, which was coming on and off, it also had an effect on the fallback position, like the informal jobs that women occupy in informal waste picking, in the factories as domestic workers, and also in trading of second-hand clothing, hair salons, and the like. Women also bear the burden of unpaid care work in South Africa and elsewhere in the world. Yeah. So the sick relatives had to be taken care of by women. The kids were spending more time at home instead of school. They needed to be taken care of. So that is why the participation of women in the workplace has suffered a drastic drop during the COVID pandemic, and the situation is likely going to persist.
Mr. Dlamini, what should governments be doing to redress this? And I mean, if you talk about issues of widening corruption, that on its own exacerbates that divide. Look at what we saw with regard to PPE graft, for example.
Yes, precisely. It is very important for us to go back and look at the underlying causes of the challenge of inequality. Some of the things that we have seen is that not just with corruption and fraud and all of those evils, but also the weakening of regulations, policies that are meant to cushion the majority of the population. What we have also seen is skyrocketing market prices, a boom in terms of unregulated entities that are in the market, and a surge in monopoly power and privatization of healthcare, of education, and all of those things that we used to think they were essential services and therefore were under the government. Not only that, there was also an erosion of individual corporate tax rates, which means governments also have suffered a lot in terms of their ability to mobilize resources. As this was happening. A South Africa report has shown us, for instance, that Johan Rupert's income grew by $400 million in 2 days when the Richemont shares soared by 5.5%. So Johan didn't do anything in particular to ensure that they increased their wealth by this much. So what we are seeing is a system, a global finance system that was structured in such a way that it promotes the obscene accumulation of wealth by a few individuals instead of supporting the majority of our people to live better lives.
Thembi Nkosi Dlamini from Oxfam South Africa, thank you very much for joining us here for a full view. Of course, giving us some insight into that report by Oxfam. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the program.
Yash go, Yash must fall. Up, left, right, round, round, it must fall. And nothing where Yash they do not is sweet. Shit, beat, fuck, it is sweet. Why not? Because Yash now wonderful material property. Whether you like or you know like, after you hear this the true talk. Whether you like or you know like, after you hear this the true talk. If you like it good, if you know like you hang, if you like it good, if you know like you hang, if you hang you go die, you go die for nothing.
We go carry your body, go police station. You die wrongfully.
Gege,
gege, gege, gege, gege, gege, gege, gege. Odi warong koto bo. See, man, I get different look for woman yash. See, see small yash go see, yeah, look at this big yash. If you can't see big yash, you go see, yeah, look at this small yash. And if you see one yash where you want to bury your prick inside, you go say, hey baby, show me your particulars. I don't know the English, you go say, hey darling, show me your living license. Particular, not be police particular.
That's it for Amanda this week. Special thanks to our long-standing correspondent, Farid Omar Abdelhamid of Guerrilla Toronto. The music you have heard this week in order was Cadeau Empoisonné by Zedes, Femi Kuti, Politics Na Big Business, and Femi's dad, Fela Kuti, in Army Arrangement. I thought that was appropriate for the kind of discussions we were talking about, carrying on today. Amandla Radio is undergoing a fundamental review of its functioning and direction after 35 years on the airways. Over the next few weeks, listeners will see how that review turns out. Your feedback is always welcome at amandla.ca. We also thank the staff at CQET for all their stalwart support over the period of the COVID pandemic and the exceptional measures they took to keep this show and the station on the air. Good night and stay tuned to Jazz Euph.
Africa unite, Batsilelile. Africa unite, Batsilelile.
Swanee Parolpopolo is back, and in real life for its 22nd edition. All the sights, sounds, and sensations of live music. After 2 years of online adaptation, Swanee is filling up the month of June with liberated music of all genres. Over 45 events and 90 participating artists performing indoors, outdoors, streamed for maximum accessibility. Record and book launches, workshops, a puppet show, a satellite Swanee happening in Wakefield, Quebec, of all places, and, of course, much more. For all the goodies, check out swaneeparolpopolo.org. Masks will, of course, be required. For your audio program guide, tune in to the Montreal Sessions, Tuesday, May 24th, May 31st, and June 7 and 14th, from 3 till 5 p.m., the Swanee crew hosts will be serving up highlights of what to expect at this year's festival. This is, of course, a CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Back again with your boy Hansel the Bullfrog. We're on CKUT Radio. Jazz, baby. It's what I'm here for. It is what I am here to deliver. Today we got a special, special order of goodies for y'all. Had a little parlay with some of my good, good colleagues by the name of Sense Beats and Monsieur Shem G, the infamous